Hello and welcome to the Art Monthly talk show. I'm joined by writer and curator Amy Bird, who's based in London, and Jennifer Thatcher, who is a freelance writer and PhD candidate. Amy will be discussing the current exhibition that's at Cell Projects called No, 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 No. And Jen Thatcher will be discussing her current feature, which sort of is a survey of the current allegations of sexual harassment in the art world and responses to them, notably the We Are Not Surprised campaign. Jen, I wondered, and Jen is actually joining us by phone this evening, so I hope Jen can hear me. I wondered if we could begin, Jen, by looking at the manifesto of the organization and some of the aims it seeks to achieve before going into any of these case studies that you sort of pull on and draw upon. So perhaps if we just start with some of the sort of the aims and objectives of the organization and sort of, and then we can look at how they've sort of, you know, why they sort of stemmed into being.
Well, I can't speak for the group other than I signed the open letter. So for those of you who don't know, We Are Not Surprised was an open letter that was signed by thousands of people from the art world in October last year. It was a letter written by 150 people from around the art world, across all sectors and genders and everything. And amazingly, it started from a small number of people speaking via Instagram to each other and then inviting more people to join. And then suddenly 150 people in 24 hours got together and wrote this open letter. This was quite soon after the Harvey Weinstein allegations, and the art world knew that they were next and they were ready. Mm-hmm. Within 24 hours of the open letter being published across international news outlets, thousands more people signed it, including myself. Yeah. You know, there didn't seem to be time to look at the small print at that point. It just seemed urgent, like we just need to say that we've been listening and we're aware that we're next and we're not immune to, you know, the art world's not a pure place. It's not immune to this kind of corruption of abuse of power.
Absolutely.
The letter started, we are artists, art administrators, assistants, curators, directors, editors, educators, gallerists, and so on, workers of the art world, and we have been, and a whole list of adjectives, groped, undermined, harassed, infantilized, scorned, threatened, and intimidated by those in positions of power. They were reacting to allegations against Art Forum co-publisher Knight Landesman's sexual misconduct, but their point was that this was not an isolated case and we needed to seize the moment to talk about abuse of power in the arts more generally. And so their line was, abuse of power comes as no surprise, which was from Jenny Hox's series Truism nearly 40 years ago or something. So it's very sad that we're still in the same position where the art world is still rife with abuses of position. So my article looked at the lead up to the writing of this letter, but also at their attempts to do something more long term, and how it was important for this group of people to carry on with this momentum and try and do something constructive. So various people, various national groups have been started to form and to start meeting publicly. Last week, I believe, the London-based group met. I was there at their planning meeting a couple of months ago, and they were just about to open up to a wider public. Mm-hmm. And I was really pleased how open they were to any suggestions on how to move things forward. The structure is, of course, non-hierarchical and is evolving with the concerns that people bring to it. But they have set up a website and various social media handles. And most usefully, they have a definition of sexual harassment which goes beyond the legal framework and seeks to contextualise it as an abuse of power more generally, and whereby the sexual part is often just a tool for manipulation, mm-hmm. and you know, the motivation is only partly sexual. And that helps to widen the sphere so that those of us who haven't experienced sexual harassment but other types of harassment can see it as part of a continuum and not some isolated instance which isolate those victims of abuse.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's exactly this kind of conversation that needs to be had, which is that often, you know, we often feel isolated, or, you know, it's a tendency in the art world to feel isolated and the conversations aren't taking place. And I agree, you know, it's these kind of situations where sexual harassment blur or become more difficult to kind of maybe name or point out, and how other kinds of forms of bullying or intimidation or other kinds of things that happen in a much more casual and throwaway way, you know, they're not being addressed with any kind of degree of any seriousness.
Well, it's very difficult for anyone to come forward with a complaint, with a formal complaint. That's something that I still find very shocking, and I've seen it across the board, even in public institutions, whereby anyone with a grievance finds it extremely difficult to bring their case forward to either legally or at least to have someone neutral to talk to. Often the art world is a place which in some levels has become professionalised, in other ways hasn't, and the way it hasn't has been on the side of workers' rights. For the most part, arts institutions don't have such things as HR departments or people who are neutral, who you can talk to. The problem I found when I've talked to people is that the very people that you would think might listen to you and help you as someone with a grievance are either the people who have been the ones who are the source of the abuse, or they have a vested interest in keeping you silent, whether that's because they're fearful for their jobs or because they are part of a board which has appointed the director or a high-level individual who's perpetrated that abuse. And so it's become very difficult for people to say anything. I've found that, or it's been pointed out to me, that that unions have not been very, until recently, have not really stood up for people in this position. Now I think they're really trying to change, so let's hope it gets taken more seriously by unions. And let's hope that institutions, whether commercial or public, start thinking about their policies, and if only to protect their workers from, let's say, third-party abuse, where, for example, if you worked in a commercial organisation and you went out for a dinner with a client and that client became inappropriate, you wouldn't necessarily be protected against that. And I know some galleries are trying to find ways to write policies that deal with such things. And the problem is that the law, employment law, is very weak in relation to workers' rights, people who have been sexually harassed or bullied. And it's expensive and difficult to bring someone to court. And people don't know necessarily where to get legal advice. Some unions are now offering free advice, or at least pointing you in the right direction. A lot of employment lawyers will give you 15 minutes of free advice, but it can be very expensive and it can be very intimidating, and there isn't much subsidy from the government, almost nothing for people bringing abusers to court. So the incentives to make a formal complaint are very low. People are worried for their subsequent reputations and careers, and I've heard from people who have had to go to another country because they feared that that references from previous employments, when they were in fact the victims, have caught up with them and they can't work in this country. So it's a very small world, and reputations can easily be damaged, even when it wasn't your fault in the first place. But, you know, whether you're a whistleblower or a victim, often, you know, as Monica Lewinsky said, the shame sticks to you,
mm-hmm.
And you become the target.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you talk a little bit about that sort of the divide, the use of social media, which is both a very powerful and kind of useful tool in this regard for sort of publicizing and kind of galvanizing this momentum around this particular issue, and at the same time how it sort of reinforces also those experiences of further victimhood. You know, it seems, you know, sort of...
Well, a lot of people end up resorting to social media. I mean, it can be used in a very powerful way, but in other ways it can be the only way in which people can publicize what's happened to them. But sometimes that can be very dangerous because people are not aware of libel laws and defamation laws, and they can get themselves into a lot of trouble. We're very poorly educated about employment law in the art world, and I had to do a lot of finding out for this article, and I was quite shocked how poorly educated I was about it, but also how poorly served we are by employment law, particularly if you're freelance, particularly if you're dealing with third party allegations. Also to do with time frames in which you can make an allegation. You only have 3 months.
I know, this is just shocking.
Is shocking, isn't
yeah.
it? And so after 3 months, that allegation becomes historical, which is crazy. So that's a problem.
Yeah. I mean, I think particularly, if you think about when one is bullied, the powerlessness one experiences through that period of time, it's not easy to suddenly then think, I've got the courage or the strength to then move beyond that in order to seek...
And the finances and all sorts. I mean, particularly, for example, with maternity discrimination, there have been some pushes to extend that period of that framework so that people can make allegations against maternity discrimination beyond the 3 months, because if you're busy having a baby or just had a baby, that's the last thing you're going to be able to do is also be taking on a court case. I know friends who have done it and won, but it's a lot to expect and ask for, and I hope that the law will change.
I guess also buried within this subject is something you sort of raise as well, is the non-disclosure agreements that also kind of try and sort of control or corral the kind of an open discussion about what's happening. Perhaps talk a little bit of how these maybe function and how, in a sense, they further kind of close down some of the history, allegations really.
So I think most people who do try and take their abuser to court will be encouraged to settle out of court. Lawyers don't like you to go to court because it's distressing, it's expensive, and it's unpredictable. So everyone prefers the settling out of court. Now, most of the time when you settle out of court, In the case of sexual harassment in the UK, it seems to me you will be asked to sign a non-disclosure agreement, an NDA, which has just come to the fore because of the President's Club and the fact that we were told that those freelance workers for that charity gala were made to sign these non-disclosure confidentiality agreements before they started work, their shift, so they wouldn't be able to say what had gone on. So they're very, they're legal, they're nasty because they really, obviously, no one's going to want to break them because you could be taken to court.
Mm-hmm.
You could only potentially break it if that person that you, alleged abuser was in the spotlight again and being accused of other things and in the public realm, and it would be publicly advantageous for you to break that. Mm-hmm. But that would be, and courts may look upon that with discretion, and your abuser may not win the case. But it's a big risk.
Certainly.
And some people are willing to take it, but a lot of people, having gone through the exhaustion and trauma of getting a settlement in the first place, which could have taken a long time, clearly won't want to do that again with someone they know to be mm-hmm. not a very nice person. A lot of people didn't want to talk to me in relation to my article. I was ready for that, but I was disappointed in a number of cases, but I understand because people felt that if they told me their stories, that they would be very quickly revealed to be the source of that story. Mm. The irony was that often the same stories came up with the same people, with people saying, oh, I don't want to say that specific story or that specific detail because I'll know it's me, whereas someone else had just told me that detail. Mm-hmm. So people are so worried about exposing themselves to further vulnerability, and I've understood, but often perpetrators, things happen in a pattern, and you don't need to take it personally. Often, they've done this several times and in a similar way.
I just want to bring in Amy. You've got something you'd like to ask or raise?
I thoroughly enjoyed your article. I thought it was incredibly meticulous in the way that you covered the campaign and also really addressed the many problems in employment law and also how visual arts organisations function, the lack of a HR department, the lack of support. And I just wondered what for you is the long-term goals of the campaign?
Like I say, I'm not one of the 150 people involved in the Not Sprites. I'm not on the planning committee and so on. But I completely support what they're doing, and I was pleased to be one of the signatories, and I will continue to support them. My feeling is to, within my power, to open up debate, to express just how much of this behaviour is out there and how there is a lack of support, and so encourage organisations to take this seriously, write policy documents, write guidance, have that available for their workers to see, encourage unions to be a lot more supportive, have unions offer free legal advice, have organisations offer free legal advice, make it possible for people to make a formal complaint.
I guess a lot of the, I wonder how, I mean, how do you enforce a kind of a code of conduct? And I think it has to come from the directors, obviously, of the institutions. And I just wanted to bring up Maria Balshaw's comment, which she made about sexual harassment, mm-hmm. and which is incredibly unhelpful when you're trying to really tackle it. And that's the largest UK public collection, the largest arts institution. And I mean, how do you, particularly from a female director, and if that's her stance on it, then how do we possibly square it? And that's certainly not a vote of confidence in kind of having a transformation of the
way. Well, I think she regrets it, doesn't she? I mean, Maria Balshaw made a comment that sexual harassment wouldn't have happened to her because she was brought up to be a confident woman and she would have just told them off. That, I think, is a lot of people's first initial reaction to, have you been harassed personally? Even a few of my friends said similar things because you feel, well, you feel a sense of pride that it didn't happen to you and some kind of self-congratulatory feeling that it was because you were this or that. No, you were just lucky, actually.
Yeah.
Or if not. If you think about it, you probably did
exactly
something. Yeah. And if it wasn't you, then you probably saw your colleagues undergo such a thing. And I think this debate is also about bringing everyone into this. And if you see one of your co-workers experiencing bullying, how do you help them?
Also,
a lot of people said that no one was able to do anything, and they just shrugged things off and just said, well, what did you expect? Or there's nothing we can do.
Yeah, you certainly draw upon your time at Anthony Dauphé's gallery. I know we probably don't want to go into too much detail about that, but you know the sort of culture of bullying at that particular gallery and how widespread those concerns or those conditions were.
I mean, I felt compelled to write about my own personal experience because obviously he was in the news, and also I knew that a number of people from the gallery or ex Dauphé staff were meeting in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein allegations and thinking about what might be the case, what their feelings were about the case and how they felt about their time at Dauphé and whether they should say anything. And then things progressed, and the Not Surprised letter was written, the Landesman case came about, and then the allegations against Dauphé were made in The Observer, as well as a criminal investigation, police investigation into him, the details of which were not revealed. We haven't really heard anything more than that, but the pressure was then on Tate and National Gallery of Scotland as the host of the artist room for which Anthony Dauphé was the curator and the instigator of this collection, which he sold to Tate and National Galleries of Scotland with various funds involved at cost price, and has been the curator of until they suspended contact with him late last year, and some made the point that this was very close to the allegations of sexual harassment becoming public, and one can draw one's own conclusions about how much anyone knew and what the correct procedure should be from now on. The point is, it brings a lot, it's potentially very dangerous, this allegation, because it goes right to the heart of the largest British, most important collection of modern contemporary, of British and international art in this country. I thought I ought to reflect on my time just to give some context to these allegations so that one could think of them in the context of a particular bullying culture and a particularly particularly unhealthy atmosphere where the boundaries between private and public life was completely eroded, and your life was really belonged to the gallery, and in such a way that people still now, 20, a long time after the gallery closed in 2001, are still reflecting on that time and still affected by the way things were run in that place.
Also, I would add on, in terms of how galleries function, it's not just so much what's private and public, but also when are you working and not working, and how so much of gallery work is social, and whether that's a patron's event or an opening, and how can you distinguish what's inappropriate or not when the context is so ambiguous sometimes? Mm. You might be a member of staff, but you also might be maybe not working, but at a staff-related event or a gallery event, and if an incident happens, I mean, it's just a question, isn't it? And I think if you're
open conversation, this is the problem with academia, I brought it up as well, where, only a sort of a third of higher education institutions in Britain have some kind of policy relating to the supervision of students and what that relationship between supervisors and students should be. Very few people seem to think that their institution had such a thing, and they certainly weren't aware if there was one. And the point is that leaves you very vulnerable as a student. It's very hard because you're sympathetic to those arguments that art schools, the art world, art schools shouldn't be over-professionalised and bureaucratised. On the other hand, you don't want to enable a situation where a serial predator can have free rein over every new batch of students that comes in, and that being an open secret, and no one seems to be able to do anything about it, like I've seen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, if you read Jacqueline Rose's article in the LRB recently, she looked particularly at the sort of academic and the sort of abuses, and also that similar argument, which is the permissive culture that sort of somewhat like the sort of bohemian bourgeois sort of backdrop that sort of like tries to suggest that the sort of liquidity or the freedoms that should be inscribed in these institutions are suddenly under threat. And of course, I think Jacqueline Rose rightly sort of, in a way, demolishes those and kind of says, actually, no, these are, you know, fictions, really, in a very articulate way.
Well, you've got to think who it benefits in the
exactly.
end. I mean, I remember a distant relative of mine talking about what fun he had in the 60s having an open relationship with his wife, who now absolutely is really resentful of that time and how she was made to think that this made them such liberal people. But in the end, it benefited him, not her. And, you know, some of my friends have also said to me, you know, we were fed a lot of lies about sexual liberation, and it wasn't that, actually. But, you know, the way that it was fed to us was in such a way that we should be receptive to all kind of, all come-ons and so on. Whereas that's not really sexual liberation. It's the woman's right to choose as well as the men's, and everyone's right to choose, and it should benefit everyone. So it's difficult. I mean, people are adults, and you don't want to infantilize people or over-legislate or all of these things in the art world. On the other hand, there is so little protection for people, and, you know, there is a law for certain things, and it should be easier for people to make a stand if someone breaks that law.
I think you may also make the very good point that it's you can't keep on sensationalising sexual harassment, because that, I think, distracts from the larger problem. And also I wonder about the kind of the calling out aspect of it, whether it's useful to name individuals, whether that also distracts from the kind of systemic problem that is kind of existing across various organisations.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because, I mean, with DOFE, in a way, it's not about an individual. It's about the fact that this involves a network of institutions in addition to his own gallery. So I think at that point it's right to name an individual, particularly as they have come forward. A long time afterwards, and clearly, you know, there must have been more people behind that than, I mean, there's always more people than actually the news picks up on. I mean, that was something that came out of my research, that the media is incredibly cautious, lawyers are incredibly cautious about printing stuff because of our defamation laws and libel laws. Mm-hmm. And so what you read is only the tip of the iceberg. And so when you read something, you can bet that not only is that probably true, but there's a lot more behind it, a lot nastier stuff. I mean, my article got watered down quite a bit. the juicier details were cut out.
Yeah,
I'm fine. I'm quite happy to protect myself and in that way. But, you know, I was curious to know what would go through and what wouldn't.
That's right. Just Jenna's referring to the fact that, of course, before we printed this article, our resident lawyer, Henry Lydiot, had to look over some of the content to make sure that we weren't stepping outside libel laws, which, again, is interesting. I mean, in terms of, I think these things hinge upon such flimsy things that we call reputations. And, you know, I think when we look at something like Art Forum, let's say, and how, you know, like, I know that the advertising, a lot of advertisers have pulled, you know, their ads, you know, from what was probably the bastion of commercial art galleries. You know, their calling card was advertising Art Forum, and that suddenly that's been robbed of its sort of legitimacy in some senses. And only last night, you know, I was talking to, you know, various people about, you know, do you write for something like Art Forum? Are you, as a writer, are you supporting Art Forum still if you continue to write for them? You know, what are the ethical and moral questions that rise up through these situations we're presented ourselves with, you know, similarly with Tate, with the National Galleries of Scotland, you know, they're implicated. They have, you know, we've covered, you know, so much conversation about how these organisations are essentially cash-strapped, and of course, something like Artist Rooms presents a kind of golden ticket for these organisations, you know, so they can present artworks in these ways that perhaps wouldn't otherwise be possible. So, you know, we're seeing a kind of...
What do you think their choices are? I mean, what options do they have?
That's a good question, and I think, interestingly, they're being very quiet because, you know, what do you do with a situation like that where you've got suddenly this other storyline attached to this collection of works? Yeah, you know, it's not an easy position suddenly for them to sort of find a way through, I think. I mean, what would they do? Have to sell the work? I mean, how would they, you know, change the sort of state, the sort of collection itself? You know, would they, I mean, they could do things such as remove any of Anthony Doffey's stature or name to those particular collections and kind of strike that. I think that would be maybe one way of going about it. But, you know, we'll see how they choose to respond to it as an organisation. That's all I can think about, you know, in terms of how they might respond.
Well, I'm sure more will unfold, and we'll, you know, it's not finished as a case. The police investigation, no doubt, is still ongoing because we haven't heard anything about that. We don't know who that. Well, I know who it is, but it hasn't been made public who that is. And more people may come forward. You know, we don't know. And you know, we don't know what the Tate knows either.
No.
And we don't know what they're talking about behind the scenes. But at the very least, they're going to have to rethink their policy in accepting donations or cut price deals, and whether they can make individual deals with people, or whether things have to go through a general policy. I mean, it's the same thing happened with sponsorship.
But these are problems that every director faces, I think. Mm. It's like a compromise, you know, in terms of the support of patrons who might be, I mean, associated with some forms of harassment or, you know, these kind of open secrets, I think. I mean, I didn't sign the Not Surprised campaign, not because I'm not support it. I think it's an incredible achievement, and it's a feat of self-organising. It's so impressive. But when I saw it published and I was reading the list of people who had signed it, there were certain people on there who I had anecdotally through friends, through working in galleries, I you know, associate with behaviour that I think is problematic, or supporting certain artists who are kind of known to kind of have questionable ways of working, and that made me hesitate. So I think I would sign it now, but now I can't sign it because it's closed. So,
but interesting that you should say that, because if you go on the Not Surprised Facebook page, there is a number of questions that they've put up which people have clearly been asking, and one of them is, my abuser signed the open letter. Can they be removed? So clearly people have complained that some of these those signatories were people trying to remove themselves from suspicion.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
it's interesting. Yeah, so that's interesting. And that's an accusation levelled at Art Forum too, that they've been running articles and writing posts that clearly align themselves with a kind of intersectional feminist agenda, all the while that their court proceedings have been going on against Amanda Schmidt.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of hypocrisy, and one needs to not believe everything one sees and reads and do one's own research. And there are ways of doing that. I mean, a lot of these places are charities. Their accounts are published in Companies House. If they're in the UK, you know, you can talk to people.
Mm-hmm.
Don't believe everything.
Okay, Jen, on that note, perhaps we'll draw a close to a fascinating and ongoing discussion about sexual harassment in the art world. As I say, The organization We Are Not Surprised has an online presence and is holding regular meetings. Do look at that website and check in with current updates. And again, if you wish to find out more, read the magazine for Jennifer Thatcher's feature, which really just go into a lot of detail on this subject as well. Okay, so let's move on. Maybe we have time to go back to Jennifer. Mm-hmm. Fingers crossed. But let's start with Amy again. Yep. You've written a review of the Soul Project show, No, 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 No. Which I suppose, I mean, let's look at if this is a subject they say examines appropriation, consumption, monotony, and exhaustion through different modes of labor, representation, and production. And it brings together a handful, 6 artists, one collective. Should we start? It's a group show. There's numerous works in it, one video, a couple of sculptures, things like that. Mm-hmm. Should we start pulling together some of the works and then we can start talking about some of the themes as well?
Sure. So I was drawn to reviewing the show having read the press release, which mm-hmm. I received in my inbox. And like, oh, wow, this looks very interesting. Kind of very, a lot of ideas that I'm currently thinking over a lot in the artists that I've worked with or the kind of in my own personal projects. Particularly this idea of questioning or playing with ideas of individual authorship, and so maybe kind of aspects of collaboration or collective working, and also kind of complicating layers of display. And I think the what was outlined in the very brief press release really piqued my interest, along with a combination of artists who some of were unfamiliar to me and some were unknown. And so I was kind of primed to have a certain type of kind of experience kind of coming to this exhibition. So within the space itself, it was incredibly slight, which I wasn't expecting, I think. And it's actually 5 artists in total. And it's a mixture of sculpture and kind of found imagery and a video work. And in terms of the work in the space, it has a kind of material, and it tries to play around material emphasis. I think Beth Collar's work, maybe we can start talking about Beth's work, because that I think holds the space the most for me. Yeah. It's a series of sculptures that are fist pumps. They are molded out of clay by hand, and it's the same pose of like a forearm flexing to kind of flex the bicep, and it's got this wristband on them, and they're kind of molded in clay by hand, and they're incredibly worked. The kind of the detail of them is really, really impressive, and it's incredible impressions of like a figure, really. And these are placed on the floor, and it's the same pose repeated 3 times in the space, and they're kind of really ambiguous. So like a lot of the works in the show, you don't quite understand what is happening here. There isn't much to go on in terms of material and space, and you're kind of looking across the room and trying to make connections between different works. And I struggled with that, and I think I kind of outlined that in the exhibition, in the exhibition review, was that I didn't really know how to approach the works individually, but also didn't quite know how to kind of create associative meaning between them mm-hmm. based on the information that was given to me, which was these ideas of monotony and exhaustion and labour, material production, kind of looking at these quite discrete objects and thinking, oh, what's going on here?
Yeah.
I don't really know what's going on here. I can't really tell.
And these fist pumps, they're a sort of sporting gesture with a sort of sweatband. And I quickly looked up the title, Rafa, Muzza and the Joker, and they are the tennis players.
The tennis players. Yes. But I only found that out, like a lot of the works in the show, a lot of the detail that I think I go into the review, I found out once I left the gallery and kind of went online and had a Google, and I was like, I don't know what these titles are. And it's Djokovic, Murray, and who's the other one? Rafa Nadal.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a great pun, and I think that happens a lot in Beth's work, and I really enjoy her work a lot. But I think it's kind of a bit obscure in this context of the exhibition. Like, I didn't quite think it's that well placed, and I didn't think that these particular series of works are directly addressing what is being claimed, mm-hmm. I think, within the room.
Was that a problem of the interpretation materials, the curation, or the artist?
I certainly don't think it's the fault of the artist. I think the artists individually are actually quite interesting, having spent quite a lot of time thinking about the work. I mean, I think there was just a lack of context, or a lack of kind of the support around the exhibition in terms of making the exhibition, and as a viewer kind of entering that space, I felt like I wasn't really given much to go on, really. And you kind of, sometimes that's a real release, and you kind of think, great, I can really kind of approach these works in a very blank starting point. But in this instance, I really struggled. I kind of grappled with each work, and as well as these adjacent themes which are kind of being presented to me in the same space.
Is that true of Cell Project's show in general, or is this a particular critique of this show?
Of the wider program in general? I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that. I think in this instance it felt particularly lightweight compared to other exhibitions that I'd seen there. Having said that, I think there was one where Dana Monroe's sculpture in space, I think it's a sculpture, it's kind of like a found object sort of sculpture, is actually something I've continued to think about, and I really enjoyed her work, and I've kind of looked further into her practice. She takes this kind of like basketball vest that was gifted to her from John Knight, which she participated in a performance at Porticus in Frankfurt for him a few years ago. And I think in return for participating in the performance, she was gifted an edition, which is worth €24,000. So that's kind of, you know, in itself is kind of, wow, that's kind of extravagant. And so she has chosen to kind of restage this edition in the exhibition with a film of dust over the surface, which she has kind of inscribed with her finger. I wish my wife was as dirty as this, which you read all the time on motorways in the UK, on like delivery vans. And I think I found that really unsettling. I think it was very surprising, and this kind of tension between her own complicity within the performance and also this gifting of an edition. Mm-hmm. And I think I really enjoyed this idea of reworking an artwork through her very kind of personal and critical way of doing some graffiti, really.
Yep. Actually, what was the performance between... What was John Knight's performance and what was Donna Monroe's? Do you know what the
As I understand it, the performance was a netball match or like a basketball match with an all-female team, right. Which sounds
Which maybe because there is an image underneath.
Yeah.
For those that aren't seeing the actual work here, it's a framed image of... a basketball shirt with a photograph underneath of an all-female basketball team.
And they're very beautiful women as well. I think there's a lot going on in terms of the gender politics of the work, his own kind of outsourcing of this performance to a team of very beautiful women, of which she's one of them. Hmm. And then this work is subsequently commercially available as an edition, to which she's gifted a version of it. And I think she's trying to... I've learned since that she kind of interrogates other artists' works through her practice in this way, but... I kind of enjoyed this very bold reworking of like an established artist's work in this exhibition. But otherwise, other than that, I did struggle to read similar levels of critique in the other works in the exhibition.
Yeah, I think particularly Gnomic was the work by Ariana Lansard, which was this... It's a sort of an image of it, or a reproduction of an illustration. I think through your research, actually, I sort of pieced together some of the meaning through it. But
that's totally speculative. That's me, like doing like a Google image search of that image because like a photo of my phone. I really don't know. I should get in contact with the artist to kind of verify that. But I assume it's a appropriation of like an album cover that she has just reproduced in a very very straightforward way. Although the title of the work, which I didn't refer to in the review, might kind of reveal something more about it. Baby, I Swear It's Deja Vu, New Orleans. So this kind of this feeling of being deja vu, or being seen again, or kind of reworked again. But it was done in such a way that didn't seem to be at all critical or at all kind of dealing with the kind of the reproduction, the mode of reproduction within the work itself. And also for me, it wasn't even very well installed. So. I mean, because the press release says it kind of complicates layers modes of display, and I was kind of, as a curator, I think really interested in that, but I found that lacking, I think, in the presentation of each work.
Was there a named curator?
Yes. Isn't it Tim Steele?
I think it's Tim. Tim's doing the program itself.
Yeah. And I did sort of watch through the video. I know you're actually more cool about the video as well, but... the video at the back by the sort of recent collaborative practice of Nancy Haupt.
Nancy Haupt, which is a great name, Nancy Haupt, I think. I kind of like the name, but it's the work. Leaves bigger questions, I think.
just briefly outlining the work.
So, I mean, they had the biggest opportunity for I mean, again, it's an oversight on my behalf for not actually realising it was a collective, because it wasn't made clear in the interpretation material in the exhibition, but in the bios on the back of the handout, which actually run longer than the press release itself. It alludes to the fact that Nazi Hat was born in 2017, so this is a new collaboration. And it's a series of videos. Well, it's one video and then some prints that have been, well, one image that has been kind of edited again three times, and some found objects which the medium kind of tells you have been sourced from a caravan installed in a room. And I'm assuming I read it as a kind of a staging of a domestic space, but in a way that felt very tenuous. Mm-hmm. There's a chemical toilet attached to the wall, and I didn't know why that was there. I mean, it didn't seem to be doing anything. And the video is a performance, or a film performance, with a kind of the domestic labour being played out over like a course of an evening in a very remote, isolated location. But I struggled.
Yeah, it's a sort of image of this figure, trying to do some certain domestic duties, like fry an egg.
Yeah, but even then, you know, I think that kind of representation of the domestic is incredibly laboured in itself, or kind of outdated, and it certainly doesn't speak to, I think the whole problem with the exhibition for me was I didn't speak to my contemporary experience of those concerns of exhaustion and monotony and kind of labour and production, and I felt that lacking of trying to look for those experiences in the works, but maybe not really seeing them strongly enough.
They're not made evident enough to sort of speak in a way that we recognise.
Did you feel that your view of the exhibition changed when you were writing about it?
I think my view of individual artworks changed when I was writing about it. I found, Lizzie Homshin, who is a monthly contributor, said to me that she felt that she should write a detective novel in response to seeing the show, because this kind of idea of deducing from the artworks and trying to form a narrative out of it is something I certainly did afterwards, trying to make sense of it, because there was a very little to go on. But I certainly appreciated more of the work after the exhibition, but I think in that space itself, it's just perhaps too partial. I mean, I'd be interested to know from the curator why that particular selection of works, what they're each doing for him.
I would sort of come to the same conclusion in a way. I mean, having just seen it on Friday, I felt a similar sort of, series of slight gestures that aren't really kind of brought into any kind of coherent assemblage of anywhere that you feel, any of these themes are being addressed, monotony, labour, etc., that you've raised. But also, I actually, I somehow did enjoy watching this sort of video at the back, I will admit, to sort of the sort of clumsy gestures of like trying to make coffee and the sort of, these kind of things I did sort of enjoy watching. But I recognise the sort of labour of that, or sort of the banality of that.
Or maybe for me, I didn't know why it had to be a video. I don't know could have been a performance. Was it a performance? Was it a video work? Even the status of the moving image was really ambiguous. I didn't know how to read it. I think as a performance, it would have been more interesting. But there was some attempt to kind of edit it in a way to turn it into a video work, which didn't seem to do anything with it. I just felt very frustrating, and I think that kind of characterizes a lot of the attempts to kind of approach each work.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so that show, should you wish to see it, continues to the 25th of March in London. Jen and Amy, a huge thank you for all your contributions this evening. It's a great help. Great to hear from you both. As I say, both these articles are in this month's issue. So do have a look. That leaves me to say thank you for listening. Good night. Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.